Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 9th, 2025, we are delighted to host a discussion on possible state-level remedies for the housing crisis. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. James Burling, Professor Christopher Elmendorf, and Professor David Schleicher. And we're pleased to have Professor Ilya Soman as our moderator today. Ilya is Professor of Law at the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Professor Soman, the floor is yours.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing an event on this important issue, and to our three participants for what I'm sure will be their many important insights. I'm just going to briefly introduce the panelists. Each of them will speak for 10 minutes. Then I'm going to give them each a chance to comment on others' presentations very briefly. And then after one or two moderator questions, perhaps we will turn it over to you, the audience. So as our first panelist will be James Burling. He is the Vice President for Legal Affairs at the Pacific Legal Foundation, where he has been since 1983, litigating a variety of important property rights related cases. He's also a member of the Federalist Society Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, Executive Committee, and is a participant in a number of other important organizations dealing with land use and property law. And he is the author of Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis, a very important book on actually the issue that we're talking about today. Professor Chris Elmendorf is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis Law School. He works in the areas of property law, election law, statutory interpretation, and administrative law. He is a leading authority in California land use and housing law and has done widely noted work on public understanding and knowledge of housing markets and public opinion about housing policy. His research has been published in numerous top law and political science and economics journals, including the Yale Law Journal, Columbia Law Review, University of Chicago Law Review, and many others. Finally, last but not least, David Schleicher is the Walter E. Meyer Professor of Property and Urban Law at Yale Law School. He is an expert on local government law, land use, federalism, state and local finance, and urban development. His work has been published extensively in a variety of academic journals and in popular media. He recently published a new book, In a Bad State, Responding to State and Local Fiscal Crises. And he has co-authored leading casebooks about local government law and property law. So we are going to go in alphabetical order for lack of a better plan. And so we will next pass the baton to Jim Burling. Jim, please take it away.
Thank you, Ilya. And thank you for members of the Federalist Society for joining us today. So I'm going to start out by talking about my passion, which is property rights. And my argument is that the right to develop and use property as an individual right really had its strongest expression early in our republic. And it was coincident with the unprecedented freedom and prosperity we've enjoyed in this country. But from the birth of racial zoning over a century ago to criticisms in the 1960s and 1970s to the neighborhood changes wrought by greedy developers and the growth machine, we are now reaping the benefits from massive NIMBY-inspired no-growth housing shortage. The right to use one's property has been effectively converted into a privilege and something that must be bargained for, where the community and government have ultimate say over what can be done with one's personal private property. Our goal at Pacific Legal Foundation is to reverse that mindset, to go back to the idea that people have rights and property, which include the right to use and develop property in a way that doesn't cause nuisance-like harm to neighbors, but benefits the owner of the property and society as a large. And there's more than a philosophical reason for this. There's a pragmatic reason as well. Study after study have shown that regulation correlates with the percentage of families who must spend more than enough of their income on housing. For example, 2.6% of people in San Diego spend less than 30% of their income on housing, which is the ideal number. Less than a quarter of people in Pittsburgh, which has less regulation than San Diego. And the public has a disconnect here. This is something that Chris Elmendorf will be talking more about in his presentation. A 2018 LA Times poll said only 13% of the eligible voters blamed high housing costs on too little home building, and more twice that number on too little rent control. So zoning reform is a place where you have to start. And it's a really, I think it's a local, not a federal response. Local zoning started at the local level in cities like Baltimore, New York City, and Berkeley. And it was greatly helped along by the federal government with model bills and legislation, starting with the Hoover administration. And zoning had its start with a blatant desire to keep minority, immigrant, and working class families out of more affluent white neighborhoods. And even in areas where there are not yet any neighborhoods, the idea is to keep people out of those neighborhoods unless they look like me. Single family zoning dominance has made the construction of starter homes economically infeasible, not to mention unlawful in large parts of the country. My first home was a 900 square foot home, two bedroom, two bath. That home was built in the shortly after World War II. That home would be illegal or economically infeasible in virtually the entire country right now. But we see little support from reform from the current administration. We harbor a disquiet ourselves with federal intervention in local housing policies. But we have to counter the mindset that I often run into. People tell me we like local control. We like our neighborhood just the way it is. We don't want people like Assemblyman, like California Senator Scott Wiener, state senator, shoving density down our throats. We had some reforms in California. For example, there's something called SB 9, which I'll get into in a bit. But that was had a lot of pushback, successful pushback from charter cities that said, look, this is a local matter. We are a charter city and the state can't control what we do at the local level because zoning is a local matter. And that won at the trial court. It's on appeal, but the appeal will take probably a few more years. My response to the idea that we have to have local control as opposed to state or federal control is, yes, I am for the ultimate local control. That is the right of the individual owner to make use of his or her property. That's the local level that I think is most important. Now, zoning reform can be a tough political hurdle. So we see that there are different ways of getting at it. I can tell you that somebody who's litigated taking cases for 42 years, a takings challenge to zoning is generally going to fail unless it's truly confiscatory. And courts don't like to see things that are too confiscatory. They just don't see it, even when it might be. And by the same token, people who claim that they and their neighbors have a right to the current status quo in zoning. So courts said in challenges to zoning, there is no right to the current zoning when you're being downzoned. In the same token, there's no right to the current zoning if you're being upzoned. But people think that they have this right. They say, we have it. I time and time again, I am in a meeting and people will tell me, but we have a right to the zoning that we moved into the neighborhood. That was our understanding that it was always going to be single family home. And therefore, I have a property right in existing zoning. Well, the answer is no, you don't. But we will see how far those arguments go, because after all, in Euclid versus Ambler, the case where the Supreme Court upheld zoning almost a century ago, the court was motivated more by political and social prejudice than any coherent constitutional theory. At this point, I'll give a shout out to Ilya Solman's and Joshua Braver's work, The Constitutional Case Against Exclusionary Zoning, where progressives and libertarians can come together and join forces and find a good theory why zoning is unconstitutional. But we can also chip away at the margins of zoning. Parking requirements that are unrelated to any need, especially near transit zones, setbacks, penalties for lot splits, height limits, all these things can be looked at, should be looked at afresh. Urban limit lines is another problem where density is confined in small areas and outlying growth is prevented. California had a series of reforms. SB 9 that I mentioned before said cities must ministerially approve duplexes and lot splits and where there's single family zoning now. But it can only be in certain key areas. And that's one of the problems. It's confined to urban areas near mass transit. These reforms are often combined with affordable housing set asides or fees. They're often combined with the requirements for project labor agreements, which means union wage, union labor, and union dues. Now, Oregon, California, Washington, Maine, Vermont have passed some reforms. And California most recently, in July 2025, passed some major reforms. And if you read about them in the newspapers, you think, oh my God, we've gotten rid of the California Environmental Quality Act, and people are going to be developed from the Oregon border down to Tijuana and across to Nevada, the Pacific Ocean, and build more and more homes. Well, not really. We had AB 130, which is an exemption to the California Environmental Quality Act. That act allows almost anybody to sue any development for any reason, or so-called environmental reason, and you have a better than a 50% chance of stopping or slowing the project down. But AB 130 is confined to non-sensitive, non-environmentally sensitive areas, and everywhere in California is sensitive. Less than 20 acres. It has to be in areas previously developed. It has to be consistent with the general plan. You have to have sometimes special design characteristics. For example, if you're within 500 feet of a freeway, you need air filtration, heating, ventilation, and AC requirements. Affordable projects have to pay prevailing wage. That is, projects that get some sort of subsidy or special benefit to make them affordable. And projects over 85 feet have to have some union labor, which they probably already have to have something that you need skilled profession. SB 131 at streamlined CEQA review or California Environmental Quality Review. For example, local agencies can hold no more than 5 hearings on a qualifying project. I didn't know people outside of California say, what, no more than 5 hearings? Yeah, because I can tell you cases where people have gone on for 15, 20 years and hearing after hearing after hearing. It just becomes a lawyer's full employment act, and nothing gets built as a result. So we have potential limits on historical site determination. So if you're in the middle of a project, you can have it landmarked too late in the project where that could kill the project itself. We have some potential Coastal Act reform and limits the ability of the California Coastal Commission to appeal to itself a residential project in sensitive coastal areas. Now, let me explain that. In California, if a local government approves a project, the California Coastal Commission doesn't like it, it can appeal that project to none other than the California Coastal Commission. It sounds bizarre, and it is, but it's a great tool for the Coastal Commission to stop projects. There's attempts to freeze a building code, put limits on transportation and develop mitigation fees. I should mention that we had our Sheets case, where many of you know that we challenged the imposition of a $23,000 traffic impact fee. The California Supreme Court said that we had a right to challenge that, even though a legislative body adopted it. But it just got out of trial court, and the trial court said, well, yeah, we know the Supreme Court heard the case, but nothing to see there. It's still a lawful exaction because we think it meets the Nolan and Dolan rough proportionality standards. Why? Because we defer to the government agencies to make that determination. Of course, it's going to work. And the last thing I want to mention is we have to have further reforms in environment in California, and I hope something is not coming to your way outside of California, and that is the vehicle miles traveled idea that if you're building a new subdivision, especially in the Greenfield area, you cannot have an increase in vehicle miles traveled by people that move into that subdivision. If you do, you have to either mitigate that, or now there's the Air Resources Board is coming up with a fee that you would have to pay. In other words, developing in greenfield areas where people might drive to and from that new development are going to be increasingly difficult to build in California. So we have a lot of work ahead to do as here and other states as well. But I think it is necessary that we have reforms if we are going to take a dent in the housing crisis, which I will say, read my book and you find all more about a lot more about it. Thanks.
Hello, everybody.
Go ahead, Chris.
Please thank go ahead. You. So, yeah, we're good. Thanks so much for inviting me to join this event. I want to talk a little bit about red states and blue states, Republican-led states and Democratic-led states as housing supply fixers. We heard a lot about California, but I think one of the things that is really interesting is that while California may have led the way in terms of escalating housing prices, and California may be the birthplace of the YIMBY movement, action at the state level on housing supply is happening everywhere. So this is a figure from a report the Mercatus Center put out earlier this year, looking at state actions that had happened just in the last year. And they classified five states as having passed major housing supply packages, Texas, Montana, Washington, California, and Maine. So some red states, some blue states, some in between states. Then virtually every other state, with the exception of a little bit in the upper Midwest and New York, maybe David will tell us about New York, has at least done something. And not just in the sense of debating bills, but actually enacting a bill that in the view of Mercatus is at least a meaningful attempt to address barriers to housing supply at the local level. And when you dig down from the pictures of what states are doing to the pictures of what individual people think about the housing supply problem, it turns out that there's actually a fair degree of agreement among Democrats and Republicans. So with Clayton Nall and Stan Oklobzija, two political scientists, I did a study a year ago in which we surveyed 5,000 residents of U.S. metropolitan regions, oversampling tenants a little bit. So this is a somewhat younger and maybe a little more Democratic leaning sample than you might expect. But on balance, if you look at the differences between Democrats and Republicans, they're not that great. So there are 17 housing policies we looked at. We categorized them as supply side market rate policies, supply side below market rate, that's subsidized affordable housing, untargeted supply side policies like permitting reforms, price controls, demand subsidies, and demand fences. In other words, attempts to keep certain people out of the market. And this figure shows both judgments about which policies would be relatively effective. That's the y-axis, as well as support. And this is the difference between Democrats and Republicans in the sample. So you can see that on policies around below market rate housing development, there's a pretty substantial gap. Maybe Democrats are 20, 25 percentage points more supportive than Republicans. But for a lot of other reforms, including things that are very populist, like restrictions on Wall Street buyers or property tax controls or permitting and parking reforms, there's very little difference between Democrats and Republicans. There's some issues on which Republicans are a little bit more supportive than Democrats, including allowing more market rate development, whether of the infill or the sprawl variety, but those differences are pretty modest. So the big picture is this isn't an area where there is a lot of partisan polarization, at least not yet. Apologies, I'm having, there we go. What do voters, what are they most enthusiastic about? What do they think is most likely to work? Inclusionary zoning, rent control, restrictions on Wall Street investments, and property tax caps are by far the most popular policies. allowing more market rate development is not exactly unpopular, but it's not something anybody gets excited about. And you might say, well, so people say they like these policies, but do they actually care about them if they have to trade them off against their other policy concerns? And as part of the study, we gave people randomized platforms of three different housing and non-housing policies, and we had them say which platform they prefer. So forcing them to make trade-offs between what they might want on housing versus other issues. And then we were able to estimate how much agreement on a housing policy affects the probability that they would choose a platform. And it turns out that some housing policies, particularly price control policies like rent control and property tax caps, are up there alongside other things people really care about, like abortion, minimum wage, controlling immigration or supporting immigration, and crime. Housing supply is a concern for voters, their housing costs are a concern to voters. There's broad agreement, big picture agreement between Democrats and Republicans, though with Democrats being somewhat more supportive of rent control and policies to build more subsidized affordable housing. And the things that people get most excited about, again, are price controls and property tax controls. So if we look not at public opinion, but at what elites in the states are doing, maybe this is a combination of public opinion and elites in the states are doing, I think we can say that both the red states and the blue states each have some distinctive strengths and some distinctive vulnerabilities or limitations in their ability to address housing supply shortages. So I think the great advantage of the blue states is there is a kind of social tolerance or an equity norm that can be rallied as an antidote to NIMBYism. Stephanie Tornello, a political scientist at Harvard, has done great work showing how even in local referendum elections, when housing supply issues get tied to questions about exclusion or inclusion, liberal homeowners can be swayed from their NIMBY predilections. But at the same time, the equity norms in the blue states also lead to tenant protection policies and inclusionary zoning policies that really raise the cost of development. Blue states also, at least California, New York, those states, Massachusetts have the superstar cities. They have a legacy problem, which I would call the value capture ecosystem. So cities that had really high housing costs coupled with constraints on supply generated a bunch of interest groups that benefited from being able to exercise de facto vetoes in concert with city council members over projects until they got their side payment. And those groups are now lobbying state legislatures to try to block efforts to liberalize supply that would bring down prices and undermine their leverage. And finally, blue states, as Jim alluded to, often have limits on exurban development. It has a strong environmental backing. Those may be good on some environmental grounds, but they definitely are a constraint on supply. And the reality is that most housing that is built in places that build housing is greenfield development. Red states, I think, have the advantage of a kind of cultural openness to business and growth. But on the flip side, there's a great new paper by Glazer and Jorko who show that housing supply is becoming much less elastic in the metropolitan regions of red states. So it's a big change from the picture that existed 20 years ago. And their explanation is essentially the suburban frontier is closing. There's only so far people are willing to drive to get to work, and maybe autonomous vehicles will change this. But with the suburban frontier closing, there needs to be some effort to allow more development in existing neighborhoods. Blue states have been willing to limit not only local government restrictions on housing supply, but also privately established covenants and servitudes controlled by homeowners associations. Red states so far, I think, have been more wary about touching those. And it's not clear whether the cultural intolerance for immigration that we're hearing from on high within the Republican Party will play out also at the state level in ways that operate to limit the workforce. And finally, maybe David will talk a little more about this. Property tax revolts are brewing. Property tax caps are very popular among Democrats as well as Republicans. But I think at least Democratic Party elites within blue states are going to operate as some check on that sentiment. And I'm not sure we'll see the same check in red states. And to the degree that states constrain local property taxes, that's going to further diminish cities' incentives to improve or allow changes to use of property that would generate more population growth and more housing development. What I've got my eye on looking forward, CEQA reform in California, as Jim alluded to, I think is a really huge deal. It happened through a somewhat unusual legislative process. And it answers, at least to a substantial degree, the criticism that Rand Salon and others have voiced that Democratic interest group politics meant that you would never see significant, or it'd be very hard to see significant reforms that would run against the wishes of labor unions. In the case of CEQA reform, it actually happened. There's major bills to allow apartment buildings to be built near transit, including on single family home zoned land that passed in Washington and that are hopefully will pass this week in California, pending in California. And no state has tried that previously. And it will be really interesting to see how those conflicts play out over implementation. I think there's a question about how part-time legislatures are going to fare against full-time NIMBYs. So Texas, Montana, and Florida have part-time legislatures, Texas and Montana more so than Florida, but they've been very aggressive in passing very ambitious bills. But in Texas and Montana, they get together only once every 2 years and the NIMBYs are running all the time. So how that cat and mouse game plays out over time will be interesting to watch. Third-party permitting, allowing developers to get permits from like a licensed engineer rather than a city building department is an idea that has some precedent in other countries. First, then was adopted in a few Republican states and is now, I think, about to migrate to California. And that's going to be an interesting idea to watch. Funded inclusionary zoning, where state legislatures require some deed restriction affordable housing as part of a project, but provide tax breaks to offset the losses to the developer. I should have had Florida there as another example of a state with a funded inclusionary zoning program, as I think an idea to keep your eye on, given how popular inclusionary requirements seem to be, particularly among Democrats. And finally, price controls. We've seen statewide rent control pass in some version now in California, Oregon, Washington. There's a proposal pending in Massachusetts. The property tax revolt are essentially rent control for property owners. So it may be that the new suite of price controls undermines all the other good things that states are trying to do. So we shall see. Thanks.
David.
1 second here. So I wanted to step back. We're about 10 years into what you might call the YIMBY era. And when California passed its first big statewide set of land use preemptions in 2016. And we're 10 years in. And as Chris showed you, there have been a huge number of reforms in the last couple of years. And I want to start off by saying, like, this is actually, it should be understood as one of the biggest successes of kind of from ideas to policy that we've seen in modern American politics. It has become an almost universal belief among economists and legal scholars and others that we have a housing shortage and that land use controls are deeply related to that housing shortage. Not the only source of it, but that we have a substantial housing shortage, particularly in our densest coastal areas, but increasingly all over the country. And the idea that a set of ideas is translated into policy is a notable change. There are a lot of idea times when experts agree and it has no effect on policy. Nothing could be more common than that. So the question is, like, why and how? And the topic of this webinar, which is statewide legal land use reforms, are central to that story. So one of the key political moves, even though there have been many land use changes at the local level, among people who support this policy change has been moving towards making land use policy at the statewide level rather than the local level. And this is not unprecedented. The 1970s saw a bunch of restrictive policies, and we call the quiet revolution in land use reform, happen at the statewide level. But the broader tradition of zoning and land use in America is local rather than state. And so this was an intentional decision suggested by scholars, me included, but mostly done by a variety of policy activists. And they had quite good reasons for doing so. Their ideas were that it would avoid NIMBYism in the traditional way, which is that if some town doesn't want to allow something, the state would have a broader perspective. It brought other interest groups into politics. So employers generally don't care about land use decisions happening at the level of an individual town, but care about broader housing supply. So employers become interested in, and potentially some types of unions become interested in expanding housing supply. It involves higher profile figures. So governors who are able to marshal mass public opinion in some areas. And importantly, for what we're going to talk about, and I'm going to talk about in a minute, and that Chris referenced, it makes the issue bipartisan. That there are plenty of opponents of land use reform in everywhere. That's opposition is bipartisan, but by bringing the issue out of jurisdictions that were one party, you got a new set of friends as well as a new set of benefits. The move towards statewide politics has a signal and well understood by everyone downside as well, which is follow through, which is states can pass whatever laws they want, but in a world where local governments have broad ranging sets of land use authorities, they can frustrate the intent of these state laws. And so a famous example of this is that California has recently seen a boom in its ADU or accessory dwelling unit housing stock, but it only did so after about the fourth law it passed that was deregulatory. The first couple, the state, they'd pass a law saying local governments must allow ADUs, and cities would say yes, but each ADU must have 11 parking spaces. And so they passed another law saying you can't include parking space requirement, and they'd say you have to have sewer hookups that cost $8 trillion and so forth. And it's only after a whole bunch of laws were passed that they whacked at the mole, they played whack-a-mole and whacked enough moles that the law was passed. And we're starting to see the same thing in other states that have a similar thing. So Texas just passed this pretty very substantial, maybe the most substantial, I don't know, set of reforms aimed at big cities in Texas. And in one jurisdiction, we've already seen a jurisdiction kind of quite cleverly say, now we can't limit things in certain ways. We're going to put our density requirements. If you're going to build in this lot, you have to build 8 stories, which would be uneconomical in that spot. And it's a way of stopping new development. We're also seeing a huge amount of resistance from trial court judges. These decisions are very frequently reversed by higher level judges, but in Montana, in Virginia, in New York, in Minnesota, we've seen trial court judges sometimes acting kind of narrowly legalistically, and sometimes with complete disregard for any content. This is my personal favorite, judge who's famous for another reason, Arthur Engoron in New York, which was involved in a land use case, and he was quoted from the bench saying, "I don't care what the zoning says, you can't build on this property." As a judge saying, "I don't care what the law is kind of a wild thing to hear someone say. But this general problem of local judges, mostly appointed or elected through extremely local processes, adopting NIMBY politics is a kind of signal trait of this era of broad statewide reforms hitting local opposition. This basic story is one that we've seen in both red states and blue states, this idea of broad state reforms. Again, they take many different flavors, some of them directly involve local officials. So like both the California RENA process and the Massachusetts MBATA process, for those of you who are interested in either one of those, are like basically setting local budgets for land use, but giving some discretion to local governments. Others are pure preemptions. So like things like Texas's minimum lot size preemption. So we have different forms of this, but we see in all these places this broader phenomenon, well, in almost all these places, this broader phenomenon of broad state laws facing local opposition. And the challenge that has emerged is, can the people in favor of these laws win enough times in order to wear down this opposition? Or in fact, will the opposition outlast the supporters. The things that are most interesting to me, or maybe most interesting to this group about this broad dynamic, is that it involves kind of several aspects of what you might think of as the things or groups of people involved with the Federalist Society. So in one set of instances, I want to talk about three ways in which the some of this politics takes place among people who are not at all associated with the Federalist Society like me, but a lot of the key politics involve both the institutional and political dimensions of people who are. So to start, the states in which we have not seen major land use reforms are notable mostly for the fact that their Republicans are not in favor of land use reforms. It is a bipartisan issue everywhere, but if you look at places like New York and Connecticut, the thing that is one of the things that is frustrated, the Democrats are divided in those places as they are everywhere, and in New York, particularly supportive of, of course, called everything bagel regulations, same type of weird anti-housing dynamics and pro-housing dynamics you see everywhere. But Republicans, not in power in any way, shape, or form, are uniformly opposed to land use reforms. And it's a very different dynamic than you've seen in places like Texas or places like California. And so the Democrats' confusion and the Republicans' difference across place explains a lot of the interstate variation we see in the politics of land use reform. The second thing is kind of what you might call the institutional face. So one of the things that organizations like GYMS have been very successful at is institutionalizing opposition to local backsliding against laws. So if you're going to have a world in which judges simply effectively nullify land use changes, what you need is organizations and developers will have limitations on what they can do in order to fight these laws. You're going to need to have legal institutions that kind of fight the good fight, of course. And you've seen some real development of this kind of in California among kind of a more kind of liberal thing, but also among kind of property rights organizations changing their orientation in pretty substantial ways towards focusing on these regulatory issues and not limiting themselves to constitutional. So, for instance, Jim and the Institute for Justice have scored this amazing victory in Montana. I don't know if that was you, Jim, individually, but it was y'all. And it came after you had a first round in which a trial court judge did something crazy, I guess is the best way of describing what happened. I could go into the details of what happened if anyone's interested, but it was, and they were, they appealed to the Supreme Court, and then they're kind of going through this process of winning, and it required the legal development. And then the final thing I'd say is the kind of what we call the organizational efforts that you see in some areas, the Federalist Society might be a great example of, which is that in situations in which we've seen ideas translate into sustained practice, it required those ideas being instantiated in physical institutions and in organizations that have the kind of capacity to last over time. And one of the big questions we're going to see in a world where state laws are only as good as their enforcement and repeated passage is whether the people in favor of these things are able to last. There's a famous quote from the famous ward healer of Tammany Hall, George W. Plunkett, who said, "Reform is a morning glory, but the party is an old oak." Well, NIMBYs are an oak. The question is whether land use reformers are a morning glory or not.
Okay, so each panelist will now have a minute or two to comment on the presentation of the others, if you so choose, and I guess we will go in the same order.
So I found both the presentations by David and Christopher fascinating, because so much of this gets down to public policy and what the voters and what people think needs to be done, which is why we have this sort of educational forum right now to try to convince the public to go the other way. Or to go in a different way that we have traditionally done under the NIMBY and no growth attitudes that we had in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and on. So what I'm really hoping to see in this movement that we have is the sustainability, as David talks about it, turning it into the oak. And I think it's going to be really difficult, because one of the challenges I see is that there are institutions that whose bread and butter is to stop growth pretty much everywhere. It could be Center for Biological Diversity. It could be on the local level, you have various, at state level, you have municipal organizations of local governments getting together, and they are generally opposed to any attempt to take away any authority and power from them. So I think that the rent seeking that goes on with some of the established institutions is going to be great. I admire the, or I would say the enthusiasm I saw for the attempt in California to overturn the traditional rent seeking by labor unions and environmental groups that we had, but how lasting that would be. I'm somewhat pessimistic, but I hope that it continues. And I hope to see continued good research from both David and Christopher on these subjects that will give me an idea what we can do next to litigate.
Chris?
Sorry, I dropped off for a bit, so I missed the question there. You were asking for responses to the other.
It was if each person has an opportunity for a minute or two to comment on the presentation of the others.
Oh, I thought they were great, but I'm happy to pass my comments to the audience for Q&A.
Okay. And finally, David.
So my question is for Chris. I mean, Chris and I, we talk all the time. So this is going to be, it's like a public airing of a private discussion, but it's one of the things that is notable about the kind of the political science around these things is thinking about it, not whether we think about it. One way to look at it is to look as you took it through voter preferences. And another way is to look at it through kind of either voter intensity or interest group formation around these issues. And one of the things that has been notable about the statewide moves has been to encourage different interest group participation, that the local level, we're looking at a very different group of people involved, either participatory in the kind of participant or interest group involved. So the question is, like, to what extent do we think that looking at voter behavior or voter preferences in the way that you do is like makes the like should be supplemented by perhaps kind of a direct analysis of interest group involvement in the way that like Sarah and Zia would?
Chris,
yeah. So I think the interest group story is super interesting and important. Interest groups are a lot harder to study than voters. And like the same interest groups, like the realtors, sometimes end up in really different positions in different states. Like in California, the realtors have generally been an obstacle to pro-housing reforms at the state level, whereas in other states, they've apparently been key allies. I think interest groups are definitely a big part of the story. But understanding how those interest groups get mobilized and what motivates them to take the positions they do is easy in the case of some groups like labor unions, but much more obscure in the case of many other of the groups that are involved in state politics.
Okay. Can people hear me? I'm worried this system might be frozen or something. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, so I thought there was a problem with the connection from it, but maybe not. I'm going to take a moderator prerogative and ask one question for whoever might care to answer it, and then we will throw it over to audience questions. My question is this: the three of you all have quite rightly talked about important statewide statutory reforms. I was wondering if you think whether or not there's any role for state constitutional reform, either by amending state constitutions, many of which are easier to amend than the federal constitution obviously is, or alternatively by making use of existing state constitutional provisions, whether takings clauses or other provisions, to engage in litigation. So that's my question.
I will say that I think there are some efforts. So before we get started, there was in the 70s and 80s a huge number of efforts to use state constitutional law to challenge the kind of broad structure of local zoning authority. And you saw some success and some failures in states. The central trouble was the same problem we see with respect to legislative changes, which was follow through, which is when it came to actually enforcing their orders, it became quite difficult for states. In a world where local governments have a lot of authority, in states where we saw some things like this, like the Mount Laurel decision, it required state courts to engage in a more aggressive reorganization and power structure grab than we've seen at any other point in the history of state courts. So I am quite skeptical that we are going to see anything of that sort in the modern era, though there are some efforts. So in Connecticut, there is a challenge to a local, a very, very restrictive town in the New Haven suburbs that brings a kind of 70s, 80s style challenge, saying that either the state constitution or more commonly the text of the state, or kind of more with the kind of heart of the claim, the text of the state's Zoning Enabling Act does not allow a jurisdiction to limit housing in certain ways. I think that there is some space for this, it is pretty unlikely to see courts doing the kind of things that that we saw in the 70s and 80s. The problems in the 70s and 80s were really different. Also, or the perceived problems were really different. We really didn't have region-wide housing supplies in that era. We had questions of local exclusion, but we're not talking. I mean, in California, you start to see region-wide housing crisis in that era, but not really in other places until a little bit later. And so the judicial organization was different. But I think that we're not likely to see state constitutional or state courts taking the lead on this in that way. My hope for state courts is that they are active. Reviewers of local decisions and do a number of things that would throw back. One other thing that I don't know if we'll all agree on this one. I suspect we will not. Is that one thing that way in which state courts have really undermined some particularly local reforms has been in engaging in very, very strict administrative review. So this has been a kind of very strong local non-delegation doctrine, and in a kind of what we call like an anti-Chevron, in which the not only is deference not given, but it is the fact of local decision is held suspicious in interpreting local laws. In this context, I think that is probably likely to be a anti-housing, an anti-land use reform area in a world in which executives are pretty systematically more pro-development than our city councils and legislatures.
So I think there is room in existing state constitutional parameters to have reform. I mean, a lot of states have not only takings clauses, but damaging clauses. But what's going to be done and at the state level, I think, depends less on the exact words of the Constitution than it does on the predilections of the justices on the various state Supreme Courts. David referred to the New Jersey Mount Laurel decision. If you read that decision, it was really unhinged from the New Jersey Constitution. I mean, it was a decision that was necessary and useful and helpful for the cause of housing, although it did take a half a dozen tries, and the Supreme Court eventually is now the housing czar in New Jersey, which, you know, you talk about judicial activism on steroids or rocket fuel, that's it. But New Jersey Supreme Court did what the New Jersey Supreme Court thought it should do. And so I think that with the existing constitutional parameters, which sometimes have stronger protections for property rights than New Jersey's constitution does, it can be used if we can get the mindset of the justices on the state Supreme Courts to recognize that there is a need to support a robust expression of private property rights and reforms that are done at the state or even local level. Montana is going to be a test, as you heard. We have a case there. where a trial judge overturned what's been called the Montana Miracle, which was a series of very good land use reforms in Montana, which have been followed up in the following year by some more. A trial judge struck them down because of the neighbor's right or so-called purported right to have their existing neighborhoods just the way they are. And I'm quite hopeful and optimistic that the Montana Supreme Court will reverse that nonsense and uphold the reforms. And I would hope that other Supreme Courts, as justices become more and better educated about the nature of the housing crisis and the cause of the housing crisis, assuming that some of Chris's data can translate into the minds of the justices, can have an impact. Lastly, as far as amending state constitutions, I don't know. That's probably a bigger hurdle than getting the justices on various state Supreme Courts to come around, because you're going to have a rather heated reaction from interest groups such as environmental groups if you're going to have any kind of reform to current land use policies. The environmental community and the NIMBY community often are one and the same, not always, but oftentimes. And that's a rather powerful constituency to overcome. Oh, and really, lastly, you do have the issue of the home voter hypothesis, Bill Fischel's work showing that homeowners think, I think wrongly often, but think that the status quo in land use patterns is the best way to protect their investment in the value of their homes or their primary asset being in homes. And so they want to stop any kind of development which would increase supply and lower the value of homes. Not everybody agrees with Fischel's hypothesis, but it's a powerful story, and it's something that has to be overcome at the local level as well.
He's on the call. We can ask him.
Okay.
I guess my views on this are similar to David's. But my views on this question are similar to David's. I'm skeptical that courts will sort of be able to persevere unless they're backed by the legislature. And so I think one-off changes to state constitutions probably aren't going to achieve that much. On the other hand, I will say that in conversations I've had with folks in Washington State, one of the reasons that their inclusionary zoning limits have not been as stringent as those in some other states, and why apparently the transit-oriented upzoning bill passed with a tax break to offset the cost of the inclusionary units, is because folks in that state are concerned that inclusionary zoning that is entirely uncompensated would be held unconstitutional by state courts interpreting the state constitution. Obviously, there are live questions about that under the federal constitution as well.
So we have about, I think, 8 or 10 minutes, and we will try to go to questions from the audience.
Yes, so thank you, Evan. We have a lot of questions, so it'll be kind of a rapid fire round to try to get through as many as we can. So apologies if we aren't quite able to make it to all of your questions. But we'll start, this is the first question asked. What, if anything, can city and county residents and politicians do to rationalize housing policy at the state level? I believe this was asked during your presentation, Jim, if you want to take a stab at it first.
So to get local and state politicians on board, I think it's an educational process. I think that, and by education, I mean people with money to make political contributions to state law. It's not something we are involved in, any kind of political contributions. But, you know, a lot of politicians go where the votes are and go where the money is. And, you know, I'm maybe sounding a little cynical, but to get them to turn around, you have to educate them, and you have to let them know that there are a lot of constituencies, some with money behind them, that are in favor of these reforms. You just can't sit back and hope someone else is going to do it.
Thank you. Sonia Trauss asks, parking reform consistently is unpopular amongst voters. but it seems to be one of the most popular pro-housing reforms in cities all around the country. So what is the best use of information about what voters like? Maybe this is a guide for candidates during election time, but not information that helps elected people at the time they're governing. So that's during your presentation, Chris.
Yes, I think that's a good way to think about it. My guess is the reason why parking reform polls poorly is that nobody really knows what it means, but they like their cars. So if you ask about taking away parking, people are like, oh, yuck, I don't like that. But it's not on anybody's priority list. Nobody tangibly understands what parking reform actually means. So you get a lot of expressions of negative opinion, but you don't get a negative opinion that matters electorally. The stuff that I think will potentially matter electorally are things like position taking on price controls and anti-Wall Street type stuff, which, again, people seem to prioritize. On the other hand, even on price controls, like a concerted campaign with enough tens of millions behind it is able to win statewide elections in California every 4 years or so. So we'll see.
I for its worth, Sonia is I think the heroic activist in this space is I think we that one of the interesting stories about parking is kind of the way in which ideas translate into policy, and so I think that we ought to maybe the best use of this information is to buy all legislators a copy of Donald Shoup's The High Cost of Free Parking see if elite persuasion is a good strategy in this area, because it seems like it's working.
Thank you. Quick question. I believe this is also for you, Chris, but really anyone. So in Florida, Governor DeSantis is pushing to eliminate property taxes or reduce them significantly. Has this been tried, and what alternatives have arisen for local government revenue? Is there a state with both no state income tax and low property taxes?
So
I'm going to send that to David.
Yeah, it's not just Florida. People don't realize this, but we are living in the middle of a second property tax revolt. The first one being associated with Prop 13, but also Proposition 2.5 in Massachusetts. We've seen huge reforms to property taxes all around the country. We've seen even a referendum that lost in North Dakota to completely repeal property taxes. The effect of this on housing supply is confusing. It will be multiplicative, and that so depending a lot of it will depend on what it replaces. In a lot of ways, property taxes are a real enemy to, or reliance on property taxes, real enemy to housing supply. And the way that this argument works is that jurisdictions often seek to keep average levels or per capita levels of property value common among their in the jurisdiction. This is Bruce Hamilton's famous contribution to the literature. Because if they allow greater development, the value of the property will go up, and they'll get a little more property tax revenue. But they will then have to provide schools and services to all sorts of the people who live in them. And so, the restrictions on housing is driven by this fiscal imperative. And so, repealing property taxes would get rid of that pretty substantially. On the other hand, which makes it getting like a full repeal, which we haven't seen anywhere, quite different from, say, California-style property tax reform, which is a shifting as well as a restriction. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that property taxes serve to increase the ability of particularly younger and more capital constrained purchasers to be able to buy houses. And the way this works is that high property tax reduces property value. It's called capitalizes into the property value. And so if you have property tax, it reduces the value of the property. Anyone who's ever bought a house knows this. One way to think about a relatively high property tax is that it, it is a little bit like a forced mortgage, in that you get a lower price at the outset, like the loan, but pay it off over time. And one thing we see is jurisdictions with high property tax, a jurisdiction like Texas, which has very high property taxes, or had very high property taxes, very high reliance on property taxes for its local services, has a much younger home buying spate group than does than do other states. And so the effects will be extremely mixed. The effects will be, I mean, if we ever see full repeal in any jurisdictions, the effects will be enormous. We're really talking about basically the end of local government, at least the end of local government as fiscal. Local governments very rarely have control over other taxes. And so we're going to be talking about state control and of finances. And we're talking about huge, huge, huge changes. No one's spending a lot of time. I mean, this is like the biggest change. It doesn't have but America isn't focused on it, mostly because it doesn't involve the president.
So if I could give another nod to Bill Fischel, he's written that the lowering of the separation of schools, financing of schools from local property taxes, led to less respect for property taxes in California, which led to Proposition 13. And I would go further saying that Proposition 13 in California, which lowered property taxes, makes it less financially remunerative for local communities to allow a lot more housing, because they're not going to get that much taxes from the housing. And it's a fiscal drain rather than a fiscal plus to have increased housing in a community, because you just can't get long term the taxes out of it. So it is really a mixed bag how lowering property taxes is going to affect housing costs and affect the financing of other state services as well. So, you know, sometimes I would say be careful what you ask for, because you don't know the unintended consequences of your reforms.
Great, thank you. I have a question here from Randall Clark, who's working with lawmakers in his state of New Hampshire to increase housing stock in the rental marketplace by amending state landlord-tenant law to make it more attractive for owners to place existing housing into the market. He asks, do any of you have experience or thoughts on doing this?
I've had many developers of apartment and multifamily tell me that, you know, the first thing we look at is whether a community has or is about to have or might have rent control as to whether we're going to invest in that community. Or rent control is a disincentive to building new multifamily housing. Now, some developers think they have it worked out and will develop in multifamily housing, but many will not. So, yeah, reform to the rent, you know, landlord-tenant laws, starting with rent control, could create a tremendous incentive for people to build more multifamily housing. You know, right now in California, we have statewide versions of rent control. I have talked to many small mom and pop owners of rental properties that are getting out of the business. They just can't stand it anymore. And we're even talking about having new eviction moratoria. As long as ICE is roaming the streets in California, some communities such as Santa Ana and Los Angeles County are considering to have new eviction moratoria on getting rid of tenants who might be afraid to make enough money to work because of the roaming ICE raids. So landlord-tenant laws, a reform of that could have a big impact. And yeah, that's it.
I would add, I mean, the specifics of landlord-tenant law are something we could talk about for a long time, and I'm not going to. But one thing I note is that there are a whole variety of laws that should, that kind of in this space that are worth considering. So one big area in this area is what are called condo defect laws. This is on the construction side rather than on the existing build side. But states differ a lot in how much a tenant can sue the developer or set of tenants, the homeowners association inside a rental apartment building can sue the developer for how long they can and for what under what conditions they can. And it may not surprise anyone to find out that the longer the period of the statute of limitations and then the broader the swath of the things that you can sue over restricts people's willingness to build rental housing. So California used to build a lot of of condo development, and now it builds almost none. Almost all apartment buildings are taller buildings are apartments rather than condos. And so we have a huge universe of tools we can think about. And one of the things we're going to see, I think, more broadly, is that as states pass land use reforms, we're going to find other limitations on growth that we've built up over the last 50 years of kind of growth skepticism. And so exactly what is constraining growth when it's being held up by belts and suspenders and, you know, I don't know what else, we will see as we see these kind of statewide deregulatory bills happen. So what's important and what's not is going to be still to be discovered.
So if the panelists agree, we will take one more question, and then we do need to wrap up because we're 4 or 5 minutes past the official time. Obviously, the topic has attracted great interest, and that's good, but we don't want to keep everybody past the time. So one more question, Matthew, if that's okay.
Okay. We'll finish with a question from an anonymous attendee, but it's, wouldn't a crackdown on crime and a renewed comprehensive commitment to law and order make a tremendous difference to the housing supply, especially in urban centers?
A reduction in crime could increase the attractiveness of cities. We saw people moving back into the cities after the crime waves of the 60s and 70s and early 80s abated somewhat in cities like New York. But I would be the last person to explain to understand what a crackdown means and how you have an effective crackdown or a ineffective one. That's beyond my ken.
So Chris and I wrote a piece relatively recently arguing that one of the things that affects kind of positive affect towards new, particularly infill development, is attitudes towards the city. And this suggests that solving urban problems, things like crime, is deeply related to whether people are going to be willing to allow housing to be built that looks like the places that suffer from these most dramatically. And so what it takes to do so is a question you're going to have to ask a bunch of different group of experts. There's at least some evidence that like more police officers results in less crime, but the specifics of crime policy, what they should do is a little like not for this group at least. But I do think that there's a deep connection between whether people like places and whether they'll allow them those places to be built in other locations. And so the reducing crime, I think, would increase housing supply increase housing demand, you know, and make it more attractive to live in places, but also it would increase support for allowing new housing of that type to be built in other places.
Yeah, one little thing I'll add to that comment is that we think of old people as being the NIMBYs, old people as being the people who don't want apartments built. And that's true today. But it wasn't true 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And the people who are old today are the people who lived in their teenage years through the 70s and early 80s when cities were in really bad shape. And people who are younger today are people who in their formative years experienced the rebirth of cities in the early 2000s.
All right. And if we don't, I think we're out of time here. So I just want to thank everyone on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to thank our experts for their time and expertise today. And I want to thank you, our audience, for joining and participating. So as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.